Be here, and rather than just thanking the organizers and Perimeter Institute for this wonderful conference, I would like to express appreciation for being part of what's been claimed to be the largest organizing committee for a conference in this area. So our work as organizers at the organizational meeting in Princeton in January was just as anti-taxing as this one, and both have been extremely stimulating intellectually. Here I want to interject a very personal note and say that our 22-year-old son, John, who hopes to get into pediatrics and mission work, is right now, or 4 minutes ago, 5 minutes ago, 8 a.m. in Saskatoon, just starting his 5-hour medical college admission test, or MCAT. So if any of you are theists or otherwise inclined to pray for him, we would greatly appreciate that. So returning my thoughts back from Saskatoon to Waterloo, I'm going to give some sort of unpolished thoughts on entropy. Whoops, my truck's falling apart. Entropy in the universe. Sorry, I forgot to make a cover slide picture, so if you don't know who I am, I'm Don Page. Okay, and the questions of how large the state space is and how large is the von Neumann entropy and such things. Well, although inflation was not invented to explain the second law of thermodynamics, after some other of its spectacular successes, it was asked whether it might solve the problem of the arrow of time. So, in this quote up here, this paper from Paul Davis, he said yes, that the recently proposed inflationary solution would give a natural explanation for the origin of time symmetry or time zeros in the universe. And then I'm obviously not going to quote the whole paper, just go to the conclusion. So he was claiming that using the inflationary postulates to postulate a universe which began in an arbitrary equilibrium state, both as far as the matter and gravity are concerned, but which, because of the linkage between the quantum state of the matter and the gravitational behavior through lambda, first gets wound up gravitationally by inflation, then gets wound up in the nuclear sense at a much later epoch by the conventional expansion. The remaining history of the universe is the subsequent attempt to unwind by gravitational clumping and nucleosynthesis. So basically, based on some of Roger Penrose's work, although I think at this time he hadn't particularly talked about inflation, but Roger had said that, you know, the second law is a very unusual situation for our universe. It requires a very special initial state. So applying this to inflation, I wrote a rebuttal article that noting that this inflationary scenario implicitly invokes time asymmetry. And one way to state that, at least in the Big Bang, is that you could say what we would get out is pretty much the same if we would assume that there were not long-range initial correlations. In other words, that if you had sort of a Big Bang surface here, oh boy, my chalk is, entropy is increasing very rapidly. Basically, if you said, you know, this region, maybe Planck size, Planck density or something, has negligible correlations with the next and negligible correlations with the next. And then, of course, you know, in a Big Bang scenario, you might say, well, okay, we have roughly the Planck density, and each little tiny region of one or a few Planck regions is in a thermal state, but there's, you know, negligible correlations. But then, of course, as this evolves, stuff spreads out from here and here, and stuff spreads out from here and here, and of course, eventually, you know, regions up, you get entanglement between what's up here, what evolved this way from this region, what evolved that way becomes entangled, and so you end up with an entangled state here. And even, well, the von Neumann entropy, if you had unitary evolution, would not change, but because of the entanglement, the coarse-grained entropy. In other words, if you just looked at one little region, at each little region, traced over the rest to get the density matrix for that region, and then calculated the von Neumann entropy of minus trace of rho, the density matrix, log the density matrix of that region, and then say, summed it up over all the regions without taking into account the entanglement, then you could get coarse-grained entropy to go up. So, I mean, maybe it'd be easier to see if I had a vacuum state here, but I had I had a pure state, but maybe it corresponds to roughly Planck energy density. But in some pure state, it's a product state, and then it goes to this entangled state. So on this slide, the very last part of the slide was not in the Nature paper, but I'm just saying, suppose we had Hilbert space regions, suppose we had a number of regions, either there or up here, and the regions have Hilbert space dimension D, and let's suppose we could even take the simplest, a two-state system. Suppose we have a whole bunch of two-state systems there, then this joint density matrix, because it's got, say if there's n of them, then it's d to the 2n, it's d to the 2n, well, it's a d to the n matrix, dn by dn, so it's dn quantity squared, d to the 2n, but it's Hermitian, and the trace is 1, so that's why the minus 1 at the end. So it's got that many real parameters. So if I put n, I chose this n to be so huge that the number of states, the dimension of the Hilbert space would correspond to what you would get by taking the number of states to be e to the 1/4 a, or in other words, e to the, what is it, pi over, 3 pi over lambda, choosing the present observed value for the cosmological constant. So if I choose that number of states, then the dimension of the full state space would be huge, and a typical state that's untangled would have, or that's very complicated, would have d to the 2n real parameters, roughly 10 to the 10 to the 122. But if it's uncorrelated, if you imagine that you started with something that you don't have correlations, then you just have a product state and you just have the parameters for each thing. So essentially you just get n states times the d squared minus 1. Or if it's two state system, then that's 3. In other words, the density matrix of your little subsystem has 3 parameters. So you get e to the 10 to the 10 to the 2. So you have far, far less parameters if you require it to be uncorrelated. Yes, Tom? So, yeah, I think I was using what I call the mnemonic universe model, which is a model that's just cosmological constant plus dust, k equals zero, and there's a coincidence that t naught times h naught is roughly 1, so t naught is very, within the experimental uncertainty, it's roughly that, and it's roughly, and it's also, there's a mnemonic device, it's put million years, divided by the fine structure constant. In other words, 13.7 gigayears. So that's my mnemonic. And I think I put that in there rather than the actual observed value. So, okay, it's a slight cheat. Okay, so then, now, another question is, does inflation require only a small initial region to have suitable initial conditions? Now that's true in physical size, but in co-moving size, it may not be so obvious. An implicit assumption is that you start off with a small region, then it evolves autonomously, and you tend to think of this happening in co-moving coordinates. But of course, there's always stuff coming in from the side, and so it's seeming that something doesn't come in from the side to mess this up is analogous to assuming a very special initial state. So let's sort of draw that just schematically. Now. So in a diagram where the light rays are 45 degrees, let's suppose that this is here and now. Then we go back along our light cone, and then, so let's suppose this is the end of inflation. And then we go, and then inflation pushes this conformal diagram way, way back. Say, and let's suppose, just for simplicity, we did have some beginning back here, then what can influence us is on this conformal diagram a huge region. Now, as Yami Gariga pointed out to me when I gave essentially this talk, it's not a physically huge region. I mean, it's comparable to the inverse of the Hubble scale at that stage of inflation, at least if you have a classical picture with slow roll inflation. But my point is, it's not, if you said in the co-moving picture, we just have this co-moving region here that evolves up to there, you might assume it's autonomous, but you're really assuming that you're not getting messed up by what comes in here. Now, if you do have the right state, I mean, if you have the Bunch Davis state down here, that may be right, that what comes in here doesn't mess you up. But I'm just saying that at least in a co-moving picture, you have lots of possibilities of stuff coming in here. And, you know, if you make some restriction to Bunch Davis state, well, that's a very special state, and you don't necessarily have that. But it's just in principle you could. Now, you might say, well, this whole region is only the size down here is of order size of inverse of the inflationary, whatever the inflationary potential was there. It's not that big, but you are, in some sense, if you're assuming unitary evolution, you're talking something about the really high frequency modes, the Transplanckian modes that normally, and I think good reason, given the past hypothesis, we put the Transplanckian modes in the ground state, and then they evolve adiabatically. Well, if we have a background, they evolve adiabatically, and they don't become excited until the wavelength is comparable to the inverse of the Hubble size. But I'm saying that is a very strong assumption, and you know, it's not quite clear whether that's right. Now, by all this, of course, I think I've long argued that inflation by itself doesn't explain the arrow of time, the second law of thermodynamics. I'm not taking that to be a criticism of inflation, because, of course, you could raise that about theories of nucleosynthesis. Theories of nucleosynthesis don't explain the arrow of time. They have to assume it. And I think inflation seems to have to assume it, or something analogous to it. Okay, let's go on now to questions of eternal inflation. So eternal inflation, with tunneling between different bubbles, suggests the universe may consist of an infinite branching sequence of bubble universes. So it's a question, are we near the beginning of the sequence or far down the chain? And if we're far down, is there a finite or an infinite number of predecessors? If there's a finite number, what sets the order of magnitude? If it's an infinite number, why isn't it thermalized? Or is it that seems to be the general picture that the state space is infinite in such a way that even though an infinite part is filled, it does not thermalize? So let's just draw a picture, a crude picture, where instead of trying to draw a space-time diagram, since after all, well, as Lenny said, Ellen's giant painting is a classical picture that's, of course, not right. I'm going to draw a different giant painting that's also not right. But if we, suppose we said, okay, I'm just going to do this schematically. Suppose we start off with some sort of initial bubble. And just because I want to, so this is our initial bubble. And then this I imagine is some sort of abstract realization of somehow the state space. And so I'm saying, okay, this could tunnel, and it could maybe tunnel off and form a different bubble. And, I mean, I only drew this smaller because I had to draw this big enough to just include the words. That's the only reason this is bigger. So anyway, it could spawn off a bunch of bubbles, and then these could spawn off. Then, of course, each of those could spawn off new bubbles, and those could spawn off bubbles, and so on. Of course, occasionally maybe you could get some bubble collisions in this picture. Of course, the idea is, of course, this space where they're spreading to is supposed to be infinite, and it's probably infinite dimensional or whatever. So it's, the bubble collisions don't have to be as common. I mean, here you might say, well, you're going to fill up the space. But anyway, I think I will take the time to draw this. I'll just draw one sequence going way out. But there's all this branching sequence. And it seems to me, crudely, if you don't draw a space diagram, but you just sort of say, where are you in the quantum state space? It seems like you're starting in some finite region. And then the picture is that somehow it's spreading out. And because there's so much space for it to spread out, it never thermalizes. So that may be the picture. It's just, I'm a little unclear as to whether we should think that's the picture or not. I mean, another way of saying it is that we might say, well, suppose we say each bubble with a positive cosmological constant has a maximum number of states at, say, well, 3 pi over the cosmological constant in that bubble. Then you might say, well, then you might say the total maximum entropy that you could get, suppose there's just a, well, suppose we do this for the bubbles of positive cosmological constants. So for the moment, we'll ignore the hats and we'll ignore the crunches. So we'll ignore all the terminal vacua. So in other words, we'll assume that this is greater than zero. So you might say that this is something like a sum over all vacua, the 10 to the 500 or however many there are of this. And so you might think, okay, if each bubble can only have a finite entropy, each bubble has, in other words, the number of states in the bubble, say it's like e to the si, with that, then you might say the number of states in each bubble is finite. It's huge, but finite. And even if you include all the bubbles, you might say there's a maximum number of states. So then you might get into the question, what happens after a very long time, after, you know, some enormous, you know, say e to the 10 to the 122, I won't put the decimals this time because I forgot what they are when you do it this way. After that many things going out there, maybe this bubble is, let's just say, same. Suppose this bubble is now the same as some other bubble over here. So now it's a question, okay, you might think of the bubble as sort of like, one way to look at it is to say, well, if it's the same as, then this is really just two amplitudes for contributing to the same bubble. This is sort of one way of producing it, and this is another way of producing it. And in that case, you'd sort of end up with a whole state space being finite, I mean, at least if we restrict to positive lambda. What seems to be more of the picture in eternal inflation is that even though the internal state might be the same here as here, that somehow there's something else that tells, like, where it is in this thing, or something else that distinguishes it. And so if that's so, that's the question, you know, what are these extra things? I mean, normally, well, in canonical quantum gravity, you say it's determined by the three geometry and independent of diffeomorphisms. So if this is just determined by the three geometry, or by the quantum state of the three geometry this, and this is just determined by the quantum geometry of that, I mean, how do you avoid the possibility that this state could be the same as that state? And I think I think the usual pictures of internal inflation assuming are that it's not the case, and that may be right, but it's just I'm having a little bit of puzzles of trying to understand what this picture views. Yes? Yeah. Well, it's in that case, of course, you do have, say they're in Minkowski space, you do have an infinite volume of Minkowski space that could make them differ. And that maybe that is the picture. I'm not strongly against it, but I'm just kind of raising the question as to what's analogous to this position in Minkowski space. If indeed we have the atoms, they're the same locally, just like this internal to the bubble, this state is the same as this. But and for the atom, we could have draw a little region around this atom, it could be exactly the same state as drawing a little region around that atom. But then you say, well, we can have many atoms because it's not just a one atom theory. So in some sense, it seems like you must go to, if it's really infinite, you have to go to not just a one bubble theory. I mean, in other words, it can't just be this number of states, this number of states per a single bubble, but the total can't just be that because there presumably is also some sum over the number of bubbles or something. So, right. Okay. So I think maybe I'm just trying to put the assumptions down. I mean, I don't really have any strong criticism for it, but I'm saying that there seems to be something like that. And then if you do that, then, of course, the total state space would then be infinite. So, okay, now let's just say a few words about how this applies. I mean, people talk about, people talk about for a fixed bubble having maybe an upper limit to the entropy being something like this. And so it's a question of how is that true? Now, I think in the holographic approach or Busso's approach and so on, we'll say, okay, if you have the de Sitter, you should just look inside a causal diamond. And so you have these covariant entropy bounds, and within a causal diamond, I could say that may be true. But suppose the space-time extends far outside the causal diamond, we're trying to look at a global entropy for the state. So let's give the example. Where are we here? What should we? Whoa. Okay. Let's see. What does the sound sound like when this is oscillating? Does it give any? the oscillations in the output. Okay, so suppose we, let's erase this one. Okay, suppose we imagine that we had the sitter, and we're going to perturb it, and I want to ask, okay, suppose I accept that within a causal diamond that you have a limit to the entropy, but suppose I just perturb the global thing. Okay, well, at a k equals plus one picture of the sitter, you could have this sort of picture where the A goes, hyperbolic, so it's basically A going like h to the minus 1 cosh ht. So that, of course, you can go way off to the future and have some k equals, this is an S3, so this would be the throat, but you could have some giant S3 up here. So up here you could have A, which is much, much bigger than inverse h, because of that. Or if you drew a conformal diagram, it would be like this, and you have the throat down here, and I'm talking about a surface up here. Now, in this picture, it doesn't look bigger, but of course we know it's physically enormously much bigger. So now the idea is that, very naively, at least if you ignore non-localities in gravity, which, maybe are the way out, if you ignore non-localities in gravity, you might say, well, you should be able to put moderately independent perturbations way over here and over there. Or in this picture over here, you should be able to put perturbations that are independent from that. So even if there is, I believe there is non-locality, but let's suppose that maybe it sort of reduces the degrees of freedom in some sense, but suppose it doesn't really reduce it down to a finite number if you have this arbitrarily large. Then you could have those things, you could add perturbations here, and it would seem like that you could get an arbitrarily large entropy. So let's for the moment accept that. Maybe non-locality really rules that out. But now you might ask, well, okay, I put the perturbation there, but what does the whole space-time do? Well, generically, if you put some, you might say, well, look, I'll just evolve these perturbations back here. Now I have a small region, and I have a huge entropy on this small region. So there seems to be some problem. Well, I think the way out for that is if you evolve this backward, you'll generically end up with a big crunch up here somewhere. So in other words, evolving this backwards, you end up with a big crunch. It doesn't evolve back to that. So it doesn't evolve back, and conversely, from the finite entropy states here, you can't evolve to this generic sort of state up here. So it seems like that there's some restriction for that, and I guess what I'm suggesting is that maybe even in a global picture, at least for a single de Sitter space, to get a finite entropy, perhaps if you just restricted, you said you have neither a big bang nor a big crunch. The whole thing looks like this, but possibly with perturbations. And then you get this sort of picture, and it's perturbed. Then you might indeed get that the number of states, is less than e to the this entropy of this that you calculate, this e to the 3 pi over lambda. Yes. Yes. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Maybe I should cite your paper, so maybe you can send me the reference or something. But anyway, now of course in this, I would want to allow that if I had enough perturbations or whatever that don't make it singular but produce black holes, I would want to allow black holes, but just as long as they decay away. I don't want to rule out any singularities in some description. I want to say, okay, let's imagine that you just require it to decay away. And of course, finite mass black holes of the Sitter space will indeed decay away. So I tried to do a model of this of saying, well, could we have a quantum state that in some sense is a mixture of all the states, all the states that do evolve like this. And if I put matter and radiation in up there, and require it, well, in this case, I had an inflaton field and then radiation, and then I could get some limit to the entropy, and you notice this is basically this three, it's like the three halves in the size rather than the full entropy that goes as the square of the size. So you don't get the full entropy by just these thermal states, But at least, you know, putting the thermal radiation in there, the point is you can't have too much radiation or the thing will re-collapse. So that's one example of how restricting the singularity. Now, another way, of course, that maybe, I don't know, somewhat similar to this picture, is that if we have a positive cosmological constant, we could perturb another solution, which is this Dreyer or Kotler, the black hole, the Schwarzschild de Sitter black hole, where basically you have the ds squared, that I should have written down the exact metric, but it's got this cosh. Doing this right, for 1 degree of freedom, say the x, but then it just has a fixed. I needed two here, I think. Just times a unit two sphere. So it's a two sphere cross. So it's basically S2 cross a de Sitter, a two dimensional de Sitter space. So I can think of the initial surface could just be. Let's see, as I have up there, initial surface on this could just be a line across a two-sphere, and that line could be arbitrarily long. So this is sort of like t equals zero, and then in a conformal diagram, well, this part expands out, so you get conformal diagram, you can get, past future infinity and past infinity here. And, okay, so this is the vacuum case. Now I imagine perturbing it. Well, in this thing, of course, your causal diamonds will restrict how much entropy you can put in each region, but we have an infinite number of regions. So again, if I make the assumption that you could perturb them independently, which I don't know whether that's true. I mean, maybe it just seems like you might think that surely there's some new degrees of freedom. Even if you fixed everything way over here, you fix it, you might think, surely there are some new degrees of freedom over there. So you could perturb the thing. Now, if you perturb it by any homogeneous radiation, it collapses. It has a big bang down here and a big crunch up there. But you could... that gives the Einstein constraint equation on that initial surface. You're allowed to perturb it. In other words, you're allowed to have the size of the two-sphere change with distance across here. You can perturb it by changing the size of this thing. And anyway, so you could add it. It would seem like you could get an arbitrarily large amount of entropy. On the other hand, when you start perturbing it, then if I added in some L factor here, something that could change, something that depends on length on x and t, and let's suppose that t equals zero, it just depends on length. I mean, in other words, well, I allow the things to stretch different amounts as it goes up. Then you basically find you can, if you perturb it, wavy thing here, then some regions where you perturb it, you'll end up with big crunching and or big bangs. Maybe they don't have to lie exactly like that. But then you may have another region where the perturbation is such that it does allow it to expand forever, so you get a de Sitter region. So you get sort of a de Sitter region up here, and then, but then maybe there's another crunch region, and then another de Sitter region, and maybe a big bang down here. You know, you have incoming de Sitter. So you can get a whole sequence of these things. And even in this case, if you just require that there be at least one asymptotic de Sitter region, it would seem as if you could get arbitrarily large number of states. Now these regions are basically separate because this is. It's not like the black hole case. This singularity doesn't go away with time. It's at the end of time. It's unlike those. So we don't necessarily, have to allow them even if we allow black hole formation and evaporation. So essentially, I'm saying if you allow this thing, you could get it, a huge number of different de Sitter regions separated by big crunches and/or big bangs down here. But again, if you excluded that, if you said that the whole thing was supposed to be one single asymptotic de Sitter region, then it seems plausible that you get a finite entropy. And again, if I just put thermal radiation about this, and then I didn't calculate any firm things, but I'd conjecture you might get similar limits on this thing. Now, another piece of evidence that if you restrict for no Big Bang and no Big Crunch, that you get a finite number of states, is that if you go back to this Freeman, Robinson, Walker, Biddy superspace model with a scalar field and A, which is essentially the same model that Neil Turek was doing, except that I'm allowing a positive cosmological constant and that k equals plus 1 instead of k equals minus 1, then, motivated by a similar talk that Neil gave in Princeton, I wrote this paper, which is now in JCAP, I didn't update the reference here, but it was published June 30th in JCAP, that you find that the canonical measure, though it certainly diverges over the full phase space, and as Hawking and I showed long ago, there's a divergent measure for both inflationary and non-inflationary solutions. So if you use the full canonical phase space, if you don't truncate it to some particular value of the entropy, as Neil did, if you lose the full phase space, it's just ambiguous whether there's more measure for inflation or for non-inflation, because both have infinite measure. But I did find if you restrict to the non-singular ones that don't have either a Big Bang or a Big Crunch, then you do get a finite measure, and the probability for inflation, it goes down. I mean, there is, with a positive cosmological constant, I guess you could draw sort of a mini superspace thing if you use null coordinates like a e to the minus phi and a e to the phi. Anyway, you get some special surface where you could start as, if you wanted to start with a time symmetric initial condition, which is a little bit like, very similar to what Jim Harlow talked about that you get from the quantum state, you would start from one of these points. The further up here, you get a huge amount of inflation. So I can't really, well, they all eventually, the scalar field crosses because this is phi, this line is phi equals zero. Here, they all eventually cross there and oscillate. But if they get up here high enough, if they get up past here, everything above here is basically moving upward. There's like light cones in this picture. So everything above here has to move in this direction. So if it gets above there, the scalar field could oscillate about the minimum, but it expands forever. I mean, there are solutions that go into here and then recollapse. And they're, you know, generically, they go off to the singularity. Okay, I don't have time to give a complete description of this, but if you allow the two-dimensional phase space, of course, you have to allow things to loop around here. So you can have things that, because down below here, they're sort of horizontal. They have to lie within this regime. So down here, they can be sort of more horizontal. And then they can turn around and basically go out here. And you can have ones that both to the infinite past and the infinite future go forever. They just come in and have a bounce and then go back out. And that gives a finite measure. It turns out most of the measure actually comes from things here where you have essentially empty. I mean, things coming in and going out. So it turns out the empty ones do dominate by some finite factor of, I forgot, 10 to the 80 or 10 to the 120 or something. But if you require that there be at least, say, 60 E folds of inflation, then the probability that the number is for at least that goes as 1 over the square root of N. So it doesn't. So that's the cumulative probability, so it doesn't go down terribly fast with N. So it might be consistent. However, I think if you add radiation modes to this, you're going to get it decreasing much more faster with a number of things. So I think if you start adding a whole lot of inhomogeneous modes, I don't think it works to say that it's uniformly distributed over this classical phase space. So, okay. So it seems to explain our observations. It may not be enough just to have finite entropy. We may need a special quantum state that has small coarse-grained entropy. I used to favor the Harlow-Hawking state, but in the Lenny-Susskind race and challenges, which I expanded in this paper, that it seems like it's dominated by empty de Sitter space, and even if you condition out observers, it'd be much more probable for them to arise as Boltzmann brains, or if you said that observers require a whole solar system, you'd be much more likely to have a Boltzmann solar system and no stars out there. So I don't think the Harlow-Hawking state explains why we see stars. But of course, it's work in progress, and maybe Jim can explain that, you know, maybe I've misinterpreted it, maybe it really can't. So for a while, I preferred this no bang state, but it seems to get Boltzmann braids. Now I tend to prefer a symmetric bounce quantum state, which is essentially a state that you assume that there's some moment, there's no singularity in either the past or future, but you assume that at some moment when the three volume reaches a minimum, that instead of having pure de Sitter, where there's just a cosmological constant, you have some inflaton, And then at this moment of smallest time, I basically take what's the closest that I can to the Bunch Davis vacuum. The only difference is the Bunch Davis vacuum really applies if you have a cosmological constant. Here I have this scalar field, the inflaton, that's maybe, you know, high up in some potential there. But I choose the state on there to match what the Bunch Davis would give at the same value of the energy density. And then you just evolve this forward and backwards. So the universe evolves forward, and you basically, if you have this inflaton, you just get the normal inflation. But then similarly, you have backwards. So entropy is increasing to the future up here and to the past down there. But of course, observers down here would think that way is the past and so on. So I think it doesn't disagree with observations, but it has no bang or anything. So then, the measure this gives, well, I had to assume some measure on the values of the phi field, and essentially I took the geodesic measure on this curve to give the measure for the phi. But the point is I have no large factor from huge negative Euclidean action to come in, like in the heart of the Hawking thing, or positive Euclidean action as in the tunneling thing. So I'm suggesting to use that, and then let's see, how much time do I have? 10 minutes. Oh, good. Okay. I thought I was running. Okay, sorry. I thought I had 10 minutes left and was needed. So I have a little more time. Okay. So the idea is that there may be this state, and of course now it might evolve to the future. I mean, you have this inflation. Of course, if there's internal inflation, there might be more bubbles and more bubbles that go on there. So now it's a question for the measure problem. What do you do? Basically, I regard the measure problem in quantum mechanical terms as the rules for getting probabilities from the quantum state. So the way I would use is I would use a Bayesian analysis if I want to get the probabilities of theories to say that the probability of theory I given observation J, our observation, would be the prior probability of the theory times the probability of the observation given the theory, and then divided by the total probability of the observation, which is basically summing this up over all possible theories. Or, of course, if you don't know all possible theories, then you can just restrict to what ones you know and just assign zero priors to all the other ones to get a more manageable sum. Now, for me, I think it's important. I'm suggesting that whatever you use with this, this is analogous to the data that we've talked about yesterday. But I'm suggesting that you put the restriction that you consider probabilities for observations that are themselves normalized. So in other words, given the theory Ti, if I sum the probabilities of all the observations, that's one, and that's supposed to be true for all theories. So the theories, I see it's not fair to allow one theory to say, well, my theory is the same as somebody else's theory. I just assign a much higher probability to the observations in my theory. So, you know, I don't think that's fair. I think that you should have it normalized. But now, and this is over all observations. So it's, in other words, it doesn't include data sets which are not observed. This is only supposed to include things that in principle could be observed. So you're wanting to get the probability of our observation versus other observations and whatever your set of observations are. Now, if you want concreteness, I mean, for myself, I tend to think of observations as fundamentally conscious perceptions. But you don't have to go that far. You could say it's, I mean, another simple example would be everything that's in the archive. So if you reduce the archive to a string of bits of zeros and ones, and you had some procedure for saying what the end is, in the beginning and the end, you could say, well, we just want the probability that the bits in the archive are this particular sequence. That could be an example of this. So now, this I did show in some periods I don't have time to talk about before, that these probabilities, if you have a large universe, such that you have more than one copy, it cannot be Bayes' rule in the sense that it cannot be projection operators, it cannot be expectation values of projection operators. But I do suggest that you could still, that the mildest generalization would be to take the probability of observation J in theory I to be given by an expectation value of some operator that might depend on the theory. Well, it would. I mean, you could have different theories with different, and of course it has to be for whatever particular observation you have, and the expectation value in the state I. So that could be, I mean, in general, that could be a C-star algebra state. If the state's a C-star algebra state, it's just whatever that gives to the expectation value. I'll put a question mark here. If it's defined by a density matrix, then that formula would just be a row that corresponds to the theory. And if it were a pure state, which I'm agnostic about, but suppose it were a pure state, then it would be just the expectation value of that operator for that pure state. So if you make these hypotheses that indeed that the probabilities of observations are given by expectation values of quantum operators, which seems to be about the simplest you could have, then it's a question as to what these operators are. And so I've made sort of two proposals, on one of which seems aesthetically better than the other. I need both of them. So the first step I'm sort of happy with, the step I'm not too happy about. The first step is what I call spatial density averaging. And that is essentially if I had this, let's suppose I had this bubble and whatever goes on here. Suppose I take for any, I want these things to effectively depend on the time since this special point here. So this is, it doesn't depend on coordinate time, but it depends on, you know, in a particular quantum state that gives this evolution. And I probably am assuming something that it's semi-classical, or at least that there's some amp probability or whatever for getting a semi-classical evolution. Then you can take, of course, the length of the longest causal curve from your event back here and say the length of that is your time t. And, of course, you'd get a negative t. Down here you'd have the t would be negative there. So then the first idea is that, okay, you have some hypersurface up here, so at fixed t, then basically let this operator be the spatial density, not the total number, but the spatial density of observations, or let it its expectation value basically be the spatial density of this observation OJ. So therefore, if the universe gets bigger, more observers don't help more as long as the spatial density stays the same. But it does favor higher density. So it's anthropically, it favors biophilic values of things in the landscape because of just favoring higher density. So then the idea is that you take it on this hypersurface or over a little smeared region that maybe has dt, and then the first idea would be that you integrate that up to infinity and back down to infinity down here and to get the total measure. A problem with that is that if there really are Boltzmann brains that are at some very tiny but positive, bounded below density, as you go forward, then the spatial density of them will remain finite, and if I integrate over that over an infinite t, I get a divergence. I mean, it's a mild divergence because it's just linear in t. It's not anything exponential, but I do get something with that. So at this stage, spatial density. The first step was spatial density averaging, which gives essentially very similar results to scale factor measure and so on, because if you cut off at some co-moving scale. And if things are up there close to the scale, it basically gives you the spatial density at that scale, or something proportional to that. Okay, then the second stage, which I'm less happy about, this is definitely more ad hoc, though it's a simple formula, is that essentially I weight this thing, let's say the expectation value of this operator on a particular hypersurface. And then instead of dt, I just put a 1 plus t squared here. And you ask what units? Well, naturally, Planck units. The 1's there only to prevent if divergence at t equals 0. At late times, the 1 is totally irrelevant. So, of course, if the spatial density remains finite, then this stays quite convergent. And so the idea from this is that, okay, the spatial density averaging then avoids like youngness problem and various problems that you get from, say, proper time measure. It's rather analogous to other measures that people have, the scale factor measure, or this, well, it's not quite the same, I guess, as the causal patch measure, but yes. Yeah. So you can have bubble nucleation. Bubble nucleation could happen up here, but then anywhere up here, I take the longest causal curve back to there, and that gives you my T. And then, of course, the surfaces, well, at fixed T, they may not be very similar to the co-moving surfaces in the bubble. The co-moving surfaces may not be the same. So at fixed T, of course, you're only, well, up to T, I mean, if you go up to some T, you're only intersecting a finite part of the K equals minus one hypersurface in there. So at any fixed T, I've sort of restricted that, and then I do the spatial density averaging, you know, over that thing. So I think the idea is that, okay, suppose I did have, you know, I had this small region, and then it nucleates bubbles and more bubbles and more bubbles, then, you know, as long as you don't get some hugely greater density of observers up there, then you're basically going to be dominated by region down here with a small number of bubbles. And if you wouldn't, if you said, well, something up there is going to have a much higher frequency of things, well, that should be in the quantum state here, because, I mean, I'm allowing, when I say that I have this quantum state with this, I allow all possible points in the landscape that give me this sort of inflation. So I can start, it's a superposition of starting anywhere in the landscape, so I can have this picture. But because of this spatial density averaging, I don't get the, and then because of this Agnesi weighting, it also suppresses the later times, so you're not going to get too much effect from the eternal inflation here. And it really is going to be dominated then by the state. So I do require a particular state. I mean, it doesn't have the advantage that eternal inflation is often claimed to be of being independent of the state. It does depend on the state because I use a measure that says I look there as essentially where I've defined the state. I don't know. Let's see. Raphael was asking me some questions about, suppose I have crunch regions where, you know, things start recollapsing. Well, if you had civilizations that started recollapsing and getting very dense, then it might give problems from here. But I'm essentially assuming that if the universe really starts collapsing, the microwave radiation or whatever's around is likely to destroy the things before they get really infinitely dense. So I don't think I'm going to have a problem with negative cosmological, with a crunch. And if I have a hat region, it's, again, I'm assuming that up there in the hat, there's only a finite density of observers at some constant T. So I don't think I'm going to get a problem. Okay, I should quit here. So I don't think it has an advantage over the others of not having problems with zero negative cosmological constant, but admittedly the big disadvantage of this ad hoc factor here. So in this picture, there's no end of time. Old universes never die. They just fade away. And I'll fade away.
Okay, questions for Don.
Yes, Alan.
Okay. I think you said near the beginning of your talk that you thought that any solution to the arrow of time problem would require some special initial state. It seems to me that if the phase space is finite, that's true. But I would say that if the phase space is infinite, that doesn't have to be true. You could imagine a system that starts in some totally arbitrary initial state. And if you evolve it to the future, entropy will increase because the maximum entropy is unlimited. If you evolve it to the past, entropy will increase in that direction too. In both regions, you'll have a well-defined arrow of time.
Yeah, I think that's true if you require normalizable states. Now, and of course, with infinities, it becomes a bit tricky because you could say, well, what meaning is there to non-normalizable states? But, you know, when I had this picture of all the bubbles, you know, I might imagine, like, heuristically, I don't know how to do it mathematically, heuristically, you can imagine a state that's sort of uniformly distributed over the whole infinite thing. I mean, it's not normalizable, so if you just say we'll exclude non-normalizable states, then I think I agree with you. I've just raised the question, it's not clear to me in this context whether not normalizable is special or not. So if I say it's special, and then that's the sense I would say it's a special initial state. But, you know, you could say, well, it's just special for the mathematical requirement that it be normalizable, and then, you know, in that case, I think you could have a solution, as you say.
Don, I just want to make a comment.